Connection is the only way. Start saying
hello and welcome to the Novel Ideas Podcast.
The Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast for two siblings who love books.
I don't love books anymore. I just love candy.
Yeah, I just love those snowball things.
I fucking hate those.
Me too. I can't stand coconut.
Who likes those? Oh my lord.
It's this woman and Woody Harrelson in Zombieland, I guess.
He likes Twinkies.
No, that's right. He was mad because there were snowballs.
Exactly.
Ah, see?
Yeah, snowballs are the worst. God, how much do you have to like candy to fucking choke down a snowball? That's my question. That's the real issue of this play.
That's right.
Central issue. Hopefully no one from work is listening. Hi, people from work.
Hi, people from work.
They apparently don't know my dark side as a swearing, angry person.
I spilled the beans, my bad.
Yeah. I kept up the ruse so well for 2 years. So, this week we read Night Mother by Marcia Norman. It is the third play in our little play series we decided to do.
Yeah, we went, oh, we haven't done Shakespeare, so let's do Shakespeare. And then went, oh, well, we're doing a play, let's do
Well, we wanted to do Angels in America for LGBT
right.
In April.
So we fit the two together, and then we went, well, if we're doing plays, we should read one by a woman, because that's, like, a thing we do.
Yeah, and also, like, I'm pretty sure all the plays we've read so far for this podcast have been written by men.
I think you're right.
Which is sad, and I don't like it. So we consciously went out on the internet to find a good play by a female playwright. Turns out there are a lot of them, unsurprisingly.
Yeah, right. In a completely unsurprising
twist
and expected development.
Women write good plays, too. And I was just kind of trawling through some lists, and it turns out that Night Mother won the Pulitzer Prize for Best Play in 1983. We also found a whole other mess of them, but we just kind of went with this one based off the synopsis. And we decided, because we were talking about plays, that we'd bring in our resident play expert.
Dramatist?
Dramatist.
Is that a thing?
Probably.
But Jessica.
Yeah. By the way. The only listener of this podcast.
Yeah, that's right.
I get shout-outs on a regular basis.
No one will be
here.
No one will be listening to this episode, because
yeah.
Our whole audience is a guest.
She previously starred in the Harry Potter Roundtable.
That's right.
In Harry Potter book 6?
Yes, I think it was book 6.
So that was last summer. But she is a... Well, she works in the theater world and knows about plays and stuff, so...
I work in the theater world. In the Broadway world, you could say.
Yeah. And you've written a fair amount of, like, reviews of plays and stuff.
Yes, yeah. So. Not recently, but I did write a lot of reviews in college and after college. I read a lot of reviews now, and I know a lot about what gets on Broadway, and I think I know why a lot of the time, and what isn't on Broadway. So.
Yeah, so one of the things that kind of inspired it was I saw an article, I think it was done by The Atlantic several weeks ago. It was when the Tony Award nominations came out, and the author of the piece was trying to figure out if, like, Broadway was being sexist, essentially, because women seem to be fairly represented in all of the categories, producer, director, I mean, I guess, obviously, actress.
Yeah.
But there were no female playwrights nominated for Tonys this year, and they were looking at the trend of women's plays being produced off-Broadway, but never really being on-Broadway.
Right, I think there are, they weren't nominated for Tonys, but there were two plays that were on Broadway this year that were by women. One was Raisin in the Sun by Lorraine Hansberry.
Who wrote that how many years ago?
I don't remember what year it was, but it was not recently.
60 years ago?
And Machinal, I don't know how you pronounce that. That's by another woman from Not Now.
Yeah.
They were both on Broadway, but they weren't. Neither of them were recognized. Well, and Arisen of the Sun is, you know, another revival.
It's, right, right. It's old enough that it's not really gonna get new awards or anything.
Right. So anyway, they existed. They were there on Broadway. Not that they necessarily automatically deserve a Tony nomination, but I don't think that's, like, that's what we're talking about. It's,
yeah.
It's the fact that there were only two out of I don't know how many plays have been on Broadway this season that were by women.
And they weren't, like, written this year by
right.
a woman. And how a ton of the stuff on Off-Broadway, like, women get produced on Off-Broadway a lot. And a lot of the more famous female playwrights, like Sarah Rule, for example, or Yasmin Ariza, that's,
yeah,
you say her name?
That's right.
Ben, have you ever heard of either one of those women?
I could not name probably three playwrights. Even though we just read three plays.
you should know about those women because they write some really awesome plays.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because, like, if you're involved in the theater world or maybe if you're just particularly aware of it, like, I've heard of those women and, like, could tell you what they've done, but I don't know if, like, the typical layman would know who these quote-unquote famous female playwrights are.
No.
But you might have not heard of the guys either.
Almost certainly have not. it's actually a world I wouldn't mind getting a little more deeply into because I know that, you know, for example, I'm not a huge movie person, but a lot of the ones I like are ones where people bitch about them having too much talking. I'm like, I love movies with lots of talking. It's like, well, maybe you should watch plays.
Yeah. Yep. Hey, Scott. Consider this. Yeah, but, so they're talking, this article's talking, you know, Sarah Rule and Yasmin Ariza, for example, like, they'll get produced off-Broadway, and they have a ton of plays that have been lauded with awards, and women win Pulitzer Prizes for drama fairly often.
This year, a woman won for The Flick.
Uh-huh.
Her name is escaping me right now.
Yeah, I don't remember her name either.
But she won this year.
And yeah. So they were saying, well, all of that's happening, why are they not actually getting produced on Broadway? Is it, you know, sexism in the system that, like, they think a play by a female playwright won't sell tickets? And maybe it's not they think they won't, they actually don't, for whatever twisted reason of how it's, you know, publicized, or the sexism of the audience, which seems weird since most playgoers are female.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, I mean, I don't know, a lot of Broadway gets dominated by musicals anyway, and that's where the big money is. I mean, the thing is, it takes a lot more money to produce a musical than it does a play in general. So that makes sense. A lot of the time, their stars are more attracted to starring in musicals, like crossover movie stars.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this year we've got Denzel Washington. He's in a play. Michelle Williams is in Cabaret.
That's, oh, yeah, I saw that.
A crossover. I don't know. There's been a lot of star casting recently. So anyway, musicals tend to do better on Broadway in general than plays, so I feel like people are less willing to take a risk with a playwright they are not as familiar with. On Broadway, because there's more of a chance of it tanking and closing and all the producers and the investors losing their money.
And is it that maybe the same number of men and women are writing weird, obscure plays that don't get produced on Broadway,
mm-hmm.
but it's kind of the same issue where, like, no, there aren't really any women CEOs because they have a hard time busting into the high-paying, high-risk business. Maybe women have a tough time busting into the high risk, but, you know,
yeah,
the higher, oh, what's the word I'm looking for?
Echelons?
Yeah, of Broadway, which tends to be dominated by men, but that doesn't mean, like, women somehow write cooler, more challenging plays than men do, just that particular, like, part of the theater world is.
I wonder if there's a machine aspect of it, too, with, especially with musicals and being such huge productions and so much money being involved. I mean, like, a really good, a really strong Broadway run can rival a good movie take, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
I mean,
up into the hundreds of millions occasionally?
I cannot talk about that because I don't really know.
Fair enough.
I probably should know. But, yeah, every Monday they put out the grosses for the week and they, like, you can see what shows have gone up and down, and it is interesting, like, what succeeds versus what doesn't sometimes.
Right.
But, I mean, it's what you would expect a lot of the time. You know, if Idina Menzel is starring in a show, it's probably doing pretty good. But the cost of putting on the show every night, like, okay, Spider-Man is not a common example, but it was costing them like $1 million to put on the show every time it went on.
Because there's so much crazy stuff
right.
going on.
So even if you get a ton of ticket sales, like, it's not gonna, you're not gonna recoup your costs. Like, the odds of a Broadway show recouping are pretty low. Not very many shows recoup. So when they do, it's a big press release. So, you know, like, everybody's like, whoa, you got your money back. Look at that.
Right, so like, we did 20, just throwing numbers out of my butt. Yeah. We did $20 million in ticket sales, but all told, it cost us $30 million to put on the play for that long. So that sucks.
So, yay!
If there's such a low hit rate, I wonder, the ones that hit must make money hand over fist at some point for them to keep doing it.
Right. Well, okay, like, the shows that have been running for years and years and years, like Wicked and
Phantom.
Phantom of the Opera, Chicago, they obviously have repeat customers, and
yeah.
people are going to keep seeing those productions until, like, we're so sick of them we don't ever want to hear that music ever.
Yeah.
So... yeah, plays don't have that staying power, I think, a lot of the time. And they don't have as much of a cult following, and I don't really know why that is.
Well, I think it's easier, like, if I was going to go out to a play every weekend, for example, I would want to see a different play every weekend, because, like, they're challenging to sit through, and they make you think a lot. So, like, I wouldn't necessarily want to go see, like... well, I mean, I guess we went and saw Eurydice 2 weeks in a row, but...
it was awesome.
Yeah. I wouldn't necessarily want to...
that's terrible.
Yeah. Yeah. Necessarily go see a play a bunch of times, but I feel like it would be really easy to go see Avenue Q or The Producers, like, 5 times, just because, like, you go and it's like, this is fun!
Mm-hmm.
And,
right.
like, I'm just gonna have a fun night at the theater! Whereas, like, it's more difficult, maybe, to go see a play a bunch of times that's, like, on a really serious topic.
Right. Mm-hmm. You probably wouldn't watch Nightmother 5 weekends in a row.
Right.
Yeah, and kind of the same thing with, like, movies. Like, you wouldn't necessarily want to watch,
The
like,
Country for Old Men.
Yeah! You wouldn't watch Old Country for No Men, like, every night in a week, but you could sit down and probably watch Easy A 7 nights in a row.
Hell yeah, you could.
Yeah! Just because, like, oh, it's fun! And so, like, maybe that's...
yeah.
Maybe that's the
well,
part of...
a lot of plays, too, will open on Broadway and already have planned only to run for a certain period of time based on the amount of money they think they're going to make. So, you know, it's a limited run for this long, and they might extend, like, once,
mm-hmm.
but they know they're going to be closing. It's not like, oh, we lost all our money, we have to close now. That
yeah.
happens more to musicals, I think. So anyway, so when you take that into account, it is a little bit confusing to me why there aren't more women playwrights if you could do a limited run
uh-huh.
and just kind of, you know, like, plan everything out financially in advance, and, like, there aren't as many risks as you would think there would be.
And I'm honestly thinking producing something like Nightmother, I mean, you have to pay, you know, the 2 actors, and then obviously all the people involved with, like, props and blah, blah, blah. I know there are a lot of people involved with that,
mm-hmm.
but just, like, the play itself is not really flashy and showy, and I imagine the cost of putting Nightmother on per night would be a lot less than putting on a play with, like...
Angels in America?
Yes.
Well, God, yeah, like, Angels in America.
Definitely.
Or, like, any Shakespeare play, because those always have a bunch of characters. Just
right.
because, like, it's way more boiled down. It's not jumping around. You don't have to worry about changing the sets. You don't need to worry about a ton of props, necessarily.
Right.
Well, like, props that they use, or, like, you know, they don't go flying across the stage or anything.
Right.
And so I wonder if, like...
well, then, when you start talking about how pared down this play is... that makes me think that maybe Broadway's, you know, just not the right setting for it.
Because it's not a spectacle.
Because it's not a spectacle, and a lot of Broadway's a lot bigger houses, not all of them, but a lot of them are a lot bigger, and off-Broadway, it's smaller, more intimate theater, and I feel like experiencing this production in a smaller venue, you get a lot more out of it than you would, like, sitting in the balcony of...
yeah, watching this show in, like, a 4,000-seat
yeah.
enormous house does seem... that doesn't quite mesh for me.
Right.
So I guess one of my questions would be, like, plays like this maybe don't work on Broadway, but, like, and not that I'm criticizing Matilda, because Tim Minchin's awesome, and it's a great musical, but, like, if you're gonna write a musical about a little girl realizing her powers and creating this mother-daughter relationship with another woman, and the main villain is a woman, why wouldn't you have a woman help write that play? not that you, like, need a woman to help write that play, but, like, wouldn't it make sense to be like, hey, I'm gonna have a woman come help me write this play? Like, I'm kind of interested why you wouldn't see more of that going on.
Yeah.
And it's a problem in the land of television, too, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
Like, most writing rooms are mostly men. Mm-hmm. That's why a lot of women on TV shows are not that great.
Well, in the article, they were talking about a lot of women who were doing trying to do playwriting in New York decided to go to the West Coast and start writing for television. And I forget who was, it might have been Teresa Rebeck who was saying that she's like, that's why TV's so good now, because
all the women,
it's all women writing for
it. Yeah, I remember listening to someone or other, maybe someone connected with the Jimmy Kimmel Show, actually, talking about how much effort they went to the first couple of years to get a writer's room that was actually balanced. Because I think the head writer for that show was a woman from the get-go, and they kept trying to bring more women in, and they said like 1 in 10 writers out there was a woman, but when they finally took them a couple of years, but when they finally got it balanced, they were really, really happy with that room compared to the boys club.
Oh yeah.
Which makes sense to me, and
I think you'd have way better ideas because you have way more different viewpoints.
We could really do an entire podcast, and not just an episode, but like an entire podcast series on this topic, probably.
Yeah, probably.
Someone probably does. Getting into the Hollywood thing again, and like, oh, what about the female comedy? And you're like, what about the comedy? Right?
Yeah, why can't we just have, like, comedies that have women characters that matter and that there. Like, you don't need, like, 100 bridesmaids out there. You could have, like, 50 comedies that have, like, a man and a woman, you know?
I don't know. I'm getting a little uncomfortable
too
here.
Too much femininity. Can't handle that.
Mm-hmm.
Too much.
Yeah, just a thought. And it doesn't help that movies at least are, like, oh, women like movies, let's, like, make a movie for women, but not consult any women, and it's just completely pandering to women, and they all hate it, because it's terrible, because a movie came out recently, it was, like, Cameron Diaz.
That's what I was thinking of when you were talking about that.
And,
God. I already hate it, you just said Cameron Diaz.
The woman from Knocked Up, the mother figure, one. I don't remember her name. Jane Mann or something?
Oh, I know who you're talking about.
And then Kate Upton and some other, I don't know, woman. And it was like, oh, I'm married to him. This guy is cheating on me with Cameron Diaz. And Cameron Diaz finds out, and the two of them become friends. And they're like, oh, he's cheating on both of us with this third woman who's this model, who's Kate Upton. And they're like, oh, he's cheating on the three of us with this fourth woman. And then it's like, the three women get revenge on the man and blah. It's like, oh my God.
That does sound like some guy's idea of a female revenge film.
Yeah. And when the preview very first started, it was just like, oh, my husband's cheating on me. And then Cameron Diaz finds out, and instead of being like, I'm going to fight you for it, they're like, what a dick. And they start becoming friends. And I was like, you know what? If this was a comedy about, like, kick the man out of the picture and these two women become friends somehow, I might actually watch that. But then it turned into like a, it's now outlandish, and it's a revenge comedy.
And by becoming a revenge scheme, it now fails the Bechdel test.
It's now all about the man. Yeah. Oh, Lord. This play would pass the Bechdel test.
Oh, definitely.
I was actually thinking that last night when we were watching Ever After. I was like, this movie fucking passes the Bechdel test.
That is a fun movie.
Great movie.
It's fantastic.
If you want a podcast just about Ever After,
we can do
it next week for Jessica and Cass. Ever After podcast.
Ever After. So, okay. Anything else to say, I guess, before we actually talk about the plot? Because we've been...
Yeah, I feel like we could go on about this topic for a really long time. There's a lot of layers. It's very complicated as far as, you know, is it just inherent sexism in the industry? Is it a boy's house on Broadway? Is it, you know...
Which
I'm not convinced it is, because, like you said, there's a lot of female producers and directors who are doing great work and being recognized for it. There's crazy good actresses, like Audra McDonald's up for her 6th Tony this year because she's a beast and amazing. But, yeah.
And women who draw crowds and stuff, too. Like,
yes. Yeah,
it's not just the male stars or anything.
Right. So I'm not convinced that it's, you know, something that is purposefully happening. And it's probably just a symptom of, you know, societal issues, like a lot of.
Well, I'm wondering if it is that case of, like, well, there just seem to be less female playwrights out there because however many years ago, a bunch of women writers were like, fuck this, I don't want to do playwriting, I don't get anything for it.
Right.
And they went to television or went to go write plays, like, in their hometown or whatever.
Or maybe they're just happier off-Broadway or off-Broadway.
Yeah.
Or regionally, like, The Mountaintop by Katori Hall. Uh-huh. Was, I remember, I post a lot of, like, regional listings for different productions going on across the United States, and The Mountaintop was in, like, so many different theaters
at the
same time.
It was
in the
Unicorn in Kansas City.
Yeah, it just, so, female playwrights are definitely being seen and being produced, it's just not on Broadway.
Yeah. All right. So, Night Mother by Marsha Norman. I'm gonna go ahead, even though it was written in the early 80s, it is 30 years old now. Go ahead and give a, excuse me, quick spoiler warning on it. We're gonna talk about the entire play, and the whole play hinges around a question of suicide, and if it's important to you to go read or see this play without knowing the outcome of that dramatic tension, then you should stop listening.
Though I think if you read the back cover of the edition we read, it
gives it away.
All of those details away.
That's nice.
Yeah, I did that. I found that out.
I think I picked it up and started reading it, so.
Should have done that.
Yeah, so it turns out the whole play hinges around Jessie, the daughter, telling her mother that she's going to kill herself by the end of the night, and the mother's trying to talk her out of it. And then at the end of the night, Jessie shoots herself, so she goes through with it. So I hope you turn the podcast off for that.
It's like half a spoiler warning, and then this is the spoiler.
Okay, so the genre of the play, family drama.
It's I was gonna say it's a play.
Yeah, of course you were. That's why I don't let you talk. You're not allowed to talk anymore. Okay, plot synopsis.
Suicide is hard to joke about.
Yeah. We were sitting here trying to come up with, like, a pithy one-liner like we usually do, and we were like, everything sounds bad.
It does.
You shouldn't make fun of suicide. So, yeah. Suicide's hard to joke about. And like I said, the essential summary is Jessie at the beginning, she's running around trying to get things together, telling her mom, you know, do you want this? Should I get rid of it? Here's where I'm putting this. Here's what I'm doing here, organizing everything. And she asks, hey, where did Dad keep his pistol? She goes and pulls it out. She's cleaning it, taking care of it. And then I don't know when she admits it. It's pretty early on. She says, oh, I'm going to use this to kill myself. And then that's where the real, you know, immediate drama of the play starts. And her mother, who's kind of just been complacently drifting along and watching TV and eating a fuck ton of candy, apparently, starts to get shaken out of this kind of, I don't know, la-la state she's been in to try and convince her daughter to not do that.
It's really uplifting.
It is very funny. A lot of jokes.
Very farcical.
I don't know if there are, like, I think the only, like, funny moments is, like, Jessie's sometimes has kind of, like, a cynical sense of humor occasionally.
Yeah.
But it's not really laugh out loud funny.
No.
It's like, oh, okay. So kind of one of the interesting things is the setting. So she just says the setting is the present. So it's not 1983. It's like whenever the present day is.
Anytime, any when.
Yeah. And I think it's kind of supposed to be in the South, but she doesn't want it to be like a Southern drama. So she, Marsha Norman made a note like, don't give them Southern accents, because she didn't want them to be distanced from whoever was watching it. And all of the stuff that's on stage and in the kitchen is none of it's supposed to give away, like, a regional location. So they can't be eating whatever kind of, I don't know, like, chips they eat in the South. I don't know if that's a thing or not. It's all just supposed to be, like, national brands, so that it theoretically could just take anywhere
right.
in the U.S.
I mean, I'm not sure that it's really aiming Southern as much as just rural, which we associate more with Southern, probably. But it's definitely supposed to be generic America. This could be happening 20 miles away from you.
Yeah. Well, not from me, but...
Okay, 50 miles away.
Yeah. She goes to pains not to make it some kind of, like, regional drama or anything, so... So don't go thinking that they're just silly hicks or anything. I guess. Alright. Who's the protagonist?
So that's... That's debatable, even though there are only two characters in this play.
Yes.
And so, with two characters in the play who are going back and forth the entire time, it could be a classic co-tagonist setup.
Classic co-tagonist.
That's right. As you'll read about in any fine drama school.
Or it's a term Ben and I made up.
Right. And so... Really, if you look at the two character journeys, I guess, you could say it's Jessie because she's taking action by the end.
She's taking control of her life and doing what she wants to do.
Taking control of her fate, yeah.
Even though that happens.
By getting rid of her life.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's Mama because she kind of has to... She kind of has to snap her bubble and, like, be aware of the world around herself.
Yeah, she, like, finally rejoins the real world at the end of the play, I think. And, yeah, gets out of her little La La Land bubble.
So, probably if you were the sort of person who had to pick one, Mama probably fits the definition a little bit better. But
yeah, she's the one who changes more, I think.
But at the end of the play, I wasn't sitting there going, thinking, oh, this is Mama's journey.
No.
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 Definitely not. And as you guys were mentioning, like, you know, one way to think about a protagonist is like, oh, who are you rooting for? And you're not rooting for Jessie to kill herself, really, because that's weird. But at the same time, like, Mama's not entirely likable, so you're not really necessarily rooting for her. So there's not, like, one character that's really clearly...
Say, maybe if anything, you're kind of rooting for the pair of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Figure their shit out.
Which comes back to the co-tagonist.
The co-tagonist.
Bolster.
Classic.
That's right. In the classical sense. In the ancient Greek sense, of course.
Speaking
Aristotle's
of
treatise.
Ancient Greek.
Fucking Aristotle.
Aristotle's treatise on co-tagonists.
Aristotle, I wish I could remember what this was called. I probably could have looked it up, but oh well. As you've come to expect from novel ideas.
Yes, the usual research standards apply.
His theory of unity or whatever on a play, he thought that a play had to take place... Same place, same time. And if you jumped places or jumped times, then you were ruining the illusion because, like, basically he thought theater should happen in real time. And this play definitely fits the bill because it's in their house over the course of, like, an hour and a half. There's not even an intermission. They just try to work through the stuff and then the play ends. So it would get Aristotle's stamp of approval, but... As has been proven by many good plays, a play does not need to necessarily follow that rule. I thought that was kind of interesting, and it reminded me of when I took playwriting, and the first play that we wrote, we had to put in one place at one time. and the professor, I think, was kind of trying to constrain people because I think for a beginning playwright, you're probably a lot more likely to try and write, like, a movie play where you, like, jump around a bunch. And he's like, okay, no, focus on one situation. They're stuck in a room together for two acts. Go.
Right.
And this is kind of that sort of play.
Well, that's effective for the subject that we're talking about and, like, the feeling of tension, and it's kind of like a bottle episode of a television show.
Yeah, yeah.
Which makes sense for this. I feel like if we were talking about how if other characters were constantly, like, entering, it would become a weird...
ruin it.
Or farcical
like
version.
Like, they're talking about suicide and Kramer pops through the door. Hey, what's going on?
Right.
Nope, ruined. Tension gone.
Or if you're telling things through flashbacks, I feel like it would take away from the reveal element of the play.
Mm-hmm.
Where you see, like, over time, over the course of a few hours, learn more about each of the women and, like, why they are how they are.
I think it definitely needs to take place in one place in one time, because that's, like, the tension build, end of play, as opposed to, like, let's talk about this, and then we'll sleep on it, and then in the morning we'll go to brunch together and talk about it some more, and then it's like, okay, well, that's not a very urgent need to commit suicide. So, you just got rid of the dramatic tension. I was thinking you could maybe have a third character show up at some point and bring something into it by both of the other characters trying to pretend like nothing's going on, but it's not really that sort of play. So I think you could maybe bring a third person in, but they would have to leave pretty fast, and I don't think they would be... Obviously, I don't think they're necessary, because the play works as is.
Yeah, and for that matter, the play only uses other characters as references.
Mm-hmm.
No one else appears on stage or in the script.
Yeah, except for Jesse and Mama. And they mention... I think I wrote it down. Yeah, they reference 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6... at least 6 other concrete characters. So, enough to cast an entire play.
There you go.
But those people never actually appear, so.
The troll version of this production have famous people listed as the other cast members. The joke being they never
show up.
Be there or on stage.
That'd be pretty funny.
I really like that one.
Like starring Brad Pitt as Gerald.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, cool, it's going to bust in at the end.
Katie Holmes as Loretta.
Don't even show up.
Dame Judi Dench as Agnes.
Totally.
Amazing.
Anthony Hopkins as the father.
Oh my gosh,
people are like, oh shit, let's go see that play.
And Shia LaBeouf is Ricky, the shitty dysfunctional son.
No, that's so great.
No.
Paul Rudd has her ex-husband.
Paul Rudd.
I just want to see Paul Rudd. I cast him in all my
productions. But you would never see
him. That's right, I cast him all it.
I cast him in everything.
He's on the cast list. He's not even a character.
He never actually... He's just Paul
Rudd.
Your
character's Paul Rudd.
Who the fuck is Paul Rudd?
Because I keep hoping that my plays will get big enough that he'll hear of me and come be in one.
And just show up.
As himself.
As Paul Rudd. They write some, like, weird, surrealist comedy play about these people, and, like, just Paul Rudd shows up as Paul Rudd.
I'm gonna go see that.
Paul Rudd is one of the people working right now who I think would actually fit really well into that role. He seems like a guy who would play that well.
Or could you do, like, the Harold and Kumar thing where you put in Neil Patrick Harris, but... He's like, as Neil Patrick Harris, but he's a total douche.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, or what was that?
And in the credits, instead of Neil Patrick Harris as himself, he's listed Neil Patrick Harris as Neil Patrick Harris.
Right. I say, what was that apocalyptic movie last year where it was a bunch of actors?
This is the end,
playing just basically douchey versions of themselves.
Yeah, I never saw that, but...
Although I bet James Franco was just playing himself.
Yeah.
He might have, who knows.
I wanted to see Michael Cera.
And Michael Cera being a total asshole.
Yeah, they're thinking of making a sequel to that movie. that's the premiere of This Is the End, and all of the actors are at the theater watching This Is the End, and then, like, the apocalypse happens at the theater.
That is so meta.
I read a thing about that.
Please do that.
I just want to see Danny McBride, because after Tropic Thunder, I love him.
Okay, sorry. I started a tangent. I shouldn't have mentioned Paul Rudd.
That's okay. This is the Tangents podcast.
Yeah. We're cool. Basically, during the outlining, the entire thing was tangents, so I'm not really expecting...
This whole outline was made by Gabs.
Essentially.
Well, Ben and I talked about pho.
Essentially, yes. So let's go ahead and talk a little bit about Jesse and Mama.
Alright.
So what's up with Jesse?
Yeah, what is up with Jesse?
What is up with Jesse?
That's right. That's the name of the after-school special version of this.
I was going to say, that's the name of the indie movie they made, basically.
Yeah. What is up with Jesse? So, aside from a strong and sudden desire to kill herself...
Well, how sudden is it? She's been thinking about it for 6 months?
It sounds like, yeah. Seriously? She's, so it's, I guess the interesting part about her suicidal, maybe tendency is not a strong enough word here, but her suicidal decision is that, it seems very clear-headed, which is not a place she usually lives in.
Yeah.
And so she actually says that the clarity is what caused her to decide.
Yes, I was gonna say, I think that's one of the most interesting points, is that she's on medication finally to, like, help her epilepsy and everything else, and because she's been thinking clearly for the past year, she's decided she needs to kill herself, and she even says, like, if I had been this clear-headed 10 years ago, I would have killed myself 10 years ago. So it's, like, not because she's... Well, according to her, like, not because she's, like, all screwed up and can't think and doesn't know what's going on and just depressed. It's, okay, I'm finally thinking clearly, I finally see the world as it is, so it's time to kill myself.
Yeah, and she even says something along the lines of, yeah, there are probably a couple of solutions, but this is the only one that will definitely work.
Yeah. Yeah, I could try this and this, but I know this one's gonna work, and I know it's gonna work now.
Right.
Which is...
She's kind of in a hurry, yeah. So, I mean, I guess the psychology of it makes you wonder, I guess there have been some critics who've had issues with that. Assuming, we had a little conversation about this, that, well, she must be depressed if she wants to kill herself. And I said, well, she's kind of presented as rational. And you mean question how rational... a decision to commit suicide
It was more like, is someone who's depressed enough to commit suicide, are they going to be as manic and active and, like, clear-headed and decisive as Jesse is being? Because most people in a deep depression are not going to be, like, bustling around the house making lists.
But a lot of people, before they commit suicide, do tend to set their affairs in order, make sure everyone around them is taken care of, and then off themselves.
Yes.
It's not unheard of. It happens.
Yeah.
And, I mean, my argument was just that, you know, she's gone through, the stages of depression or the stages of grief, so to speak, and she's come to the acceptance period, and this is how her depression is manifesting itself as, like... very crystal clear decision making, which is strange. It's really weird, and it's hard to stomach, and it's difficult. And I feel like that's why this play won the Pulitzer because you can talk about this for ever.
Well, like, is she depressed? Did she somehow move beyond her depression in a weird way, or is she, like, just so, like, weirdly depressed beyond, like, the point of no return that she's kind of, like, become this new creature?
She's
like
dissociated herself to the point where she's not even thinking of it in human terms anymore.
Yeah.
She's just, like, ready to be done. I don't know.
I mean, let's see, how did I phrase it earlier? Like, it almost is raising the question of why is choosing to live the only rational side of that coin?
Yeah.
Like, we're all kind of biased towards life because we're all living.
Yeah. I tend to think if you want to commit suicide, then you're probably not completely irrational.
Right. I mean, I'm inclined to agree, but the play kind of, like, I finished the play, and it never occurred to me that she was currently in a state of depression. It's like, it almost seems presented like she's finally come out of her depression, and now that she's not depressed, she's like, ah, man, I feel much better. Now I can finally kill myself.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I guess the big, I don't think it really matters whether or not she's depressed, like, I don't think you need to sit there and figure out for sure, because I don't think the author's being like, this is what all depressed people are like.
Right.
Which is one of the problems with criticizing, like, oh, she doesn't act like typical depressed people act, is, yeah. Well, she's not supposed to be all depressed people, she's her, and a typically severely depressed person, I was just thinking this, would not make a very interesting dramatic character.
No.
Not, yeah, because, like, if you're really depressed a lot of the time, you're not active, and you're just kind of like, I can't function right. because I'm so fucked up.
You sleep 16 hours a day.
Yeah.
You sit in your bathrobe and watch The Princess Bride 9 times in a row.
Like Patton Oswalt.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I know, he, like, tells that joke. It's like, oh, it's funny and horrible.
Right, exactly.
So I think that's also part of the reason she probably doesn't act quote-unquote typical is because it's play, mm-hmm. and she needs
right.
to be dynamic. But I do like the thought that Jessica was saying that, well, it might not be typical of a depressed person, but of a pre-suicidal person, I actually think it does kind of sound like it fits the bill, so.
Yeah.
I'm okay with her presentation, personally.
Yeah, well, I mean, some of the presentation aspects of it are, I mean, suicide is pretty heavy, depression is pretty heavy, yeah. Epilepsy, especially if you didn't really know what it was and was about, would be pretty scary and heavy, and like this play could have taken a direction where it was about any of those things, and on a surface level you could probably read it especially if you weren't very thoughtful and go, oh, this is a play about how epilepsy sucks and we should be nice to epileptic people. Like, you really could come away with that.
I guess you could.
If you were kind of a shallow dumbass. But
well, I mean, at least you, like, would be better for it.
Right. None of those things are the point. Those are all just window dressing. Like, when you start getting to the thematic stuff with the play, that is, suicide is actually not it, even though it is the plot device.
Yeah, I mean, the real purpose is relationship between mother and daughter.
Right.
And, like, how they relate to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, can their relationship, I don't know if this is the right question, can the relationship save Jesse, but more just, like, can the mother, like, really grasp what's going on, and can Jesse get through to her, and I guess on the flip side, can the mother get through to Jesse?
Yeah, one thing we didn't talk about when we were outlining that I think would probably come up in, like, a classroom discussion of this would be, do we consider this suicide to be Mama's fault, partially, or in some way?
Mama thinks so at the very end
mm-hmm.
there.
She does. We should probably just talk about Mama a little bit, too.
Yeah.
Her character and then kind of talk about
yeah.
her.
We could do that.
Yeah, so she's a gigantic sweet tooth.
Yeah.
Not really relevant to what we're talking about, but it's kind of hard to miss.
She eats goddamn
She
candy.
Loves all of the candy.
Yeah, that's like one of the things during the play is Jesse keeps offering her sweets, and she's like, no.
It's like, but you like sweets, except for Coco.
Yeah.
Because you both hate milk, apparently.
Yeah, I don't know what that was about.
That was strange.
That was rather strange.
But yeah, so she's this older woman. Her husband's dead. Jessie's like in her late 30s or early 40s. So Mom is, you know, probably in her 60s.
Yeah, 60-ish.
And she lives at home, and her daughter basically just takes care of everything. Like, laundry, shopping, pills, everything. And the mother just kind of seems to sit around and
watch TV.
But yeah, not really be aware of things.
Yeah. She kind of lives in a haze.
Yeah. She's kind of got her own mental problems.
See, now Mama comes across more as depressed to me.
Yeah.
If either of them does.
More stereotypically.
Yeah.
Yeah. sitting around eating sweets and watching TV all day.
That does sound...
Yeah.
Rather.
Although, she did, the playwright does make the point that Jessie's not typically like she is in this 2 hours of play.
Right, in the little character description.
Very true.
In control of mind and body for the first time in a long time.
Yeah. But, yeah, Mama's whole purpose, like, for a while was just to kind of, like, fit in, and she wanted her kids to do what they were supposed to do. And so you find out that, like, throughout the course of the play, there are several reveals that show that Mama's been holding in these secrets that are actually, like, a pretty big deal in an effort to try and, protect her children or protect herself in the view of society or whatever the case is.
Right.
So, the first thing that she gets point blank asked is whether or not she loved her husband. And she admits that she didn't.
She actually admits it pretty
readily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they didn't really have to drag it out of her.
Just kind of like, did you love Dad? She's like,
oh, no.
No.
I always suspected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a bombshell that was not received as a bombshell, kind of.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Understated.
Well, it more starts, like, giving you an idea of, like, what was really going on with the family. She's like, well, no, I didn't really love your father. And then she starts talking about, like, why. And, like, why their relationship was screwed up. And it wasn't necessarily, like, the father was, like, a terrible person. Like, Jessica's saying, like, the husbands in this play haven't been cheating on their wives or hitting their wives or any of that typical, like, villain behavior.
They're just kind of absent. They're sort of, like... I mean, I know this isn't supposed to be in the South, but when I think of, like, a Southern guy, you're raised to be kind of distant and, you know, you're the provider, so you need to stay away from that emotion and stuff and leave that to the women folk, and you go fishing and you take care of the farm or, you know, whatever it is
the
you need to do.
The strong silent.
Yeah, the strong
almost
silent.
This, yeah, this aloof demigod
right.
on top of Mount Olympus watching everything.
Yeah.
Right.
And it sounds like the father... was a lot, like more distant, wouldn't really talk to his wife, just wasn't involved. And she's the sort of person who, like, really needs...
She's constantly talking.
Yeah, emotional involvement in someone talking to her. So it's not a good match. Whereas her daughter, Jessie, was a lot more like her father in that she's kind of weird and distant. It doesn't really want to talk to people. And
yeah, and, you know, I think... I say maybe Jessie could have learned a healthier version of that in a more open household.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because, you know, Mama's suppressing, trying to maintain this illusion of the American family, I guess. And even hiding the epilepsy for a long time, apparently.
Yeah, so that was the next thing.
Yeah.
That she, first of all, suspected that the father was epileptic, because he just kind of seemed to space out, like, when he was sitting on his own and maybe having little seizures, but, you know, the falling down on the floor, shaking sort of thing.
Which is what Jessie had.
Right. Jessie had the grandma, and her mother never told her entire life, and then after she got married, she went horseback riding and fell off the horse. And her husband thought that, like, this accident was what started causing her seizures. But then you find out at the end of the play that she's been having them since she was, like, 5.
Yeah, and the seizure probably made her fall off the horse rather than the head
right.
injury falling off the horse starting up the seizures.
Exactly. And that Mama would just kind of tend to her in her seizure and then, like, prop her back up on her chair or whatever.
Or, like, put her in bed.
Uh-huh. And you can't remember your seizure because your brain's freaking out.
Right.
So she would just be like, oh, yeah, you just, like, you know, fell asleep or spaced out for a second. And, like, Jessie doesn't know any better because, like, no one's freaking out. So she isn't aware that she's been having these seizures.
That makes me so mad at Mama.
That's an
that
awful
makes me
thing
so
to do.
Mad at her. Like, as a mother, you're not taking your child... to see a doctor to treat a really serious medical condition
yeah.
because you're worried about your reputation.
Yeah, what people
that
think.
Makes me so mad. That's so bad.
Oh, it's awful. It's a terrible thing that...
Like, when you find that out about her, I think you start to understand more why Jessie wants to kill herself. Like, I mean, I'm not a proponent of her doing that, necessarily, but, like, I get it more.
And I don't think Jessie fully blames her mother, either.
No.
If she does, she's going out of her way to not say it directly.
Yeah. She's actually really kind to her at the end.
She really is, yeah.
This is what you're gonna do. Don't go into my room. I don't want anyone to accuse you. Mm-hmm. Call my brother. Call the cops.
And, mm-hmm. I mean, talking about when she talks about the rest of the family, like, she has a lot of trouble seeing any of them, it sounds like. And maybe this kind of detached, like, this facade of things being normal really caused some problems for everybody.
Yeah.
Because brother Daryl,
mm-hmm.
He kind of tries to help a little bit, but it sounds like he doesn't really know how. Like, he finally had, sometime in the recent past, finally had, like, a real conversation with Jessie for, I don't know, maybe the first time ever. And Mama was going, well, maybe you guys could do that more often. And she said, it was weird, basically. Like, it's probably not a good thing that we're doing that with what we're used to. And when Daryl comes over to help, he, like, comes over to, oh, well, you know, I'll... He's going to help by cleaning the gutters, not by, like, providing emotional support.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And that seems to... Maybe that's the thing, is that even though Mama is kind of the ultimate deceiver at the end of it all, is that she's the only one who is willing to, like, try and make an emotional connection with Jessie, whose, like, husband left her because, like, he basically couldn't cope with it. And she doesn't really blame him for that, because she thinks she's fucked up enough that she's hard to cope with. But, I mean, essentially, like, he couldn't deal with it and left.
Mm-hmm.
And then her son's just, like, a complete... fuck up.
Yeah, he's a petty criminal that she is pretty convinced is going to be just in jail forever someday.
Yeah, and one of the things Mom keeps trying to say to keep her around is like, maybe, like, I mean, he's old enough, he'll probably get married, and then he'll have to, like, come over with the grandkids, and you have to, like, hang out with your grandkids. And she's like, Mom, he's not gonna do that.
She's like, first of all, that sounds awful, I don't want to do
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
And, like, yeah, she, like, can't connect with her brother, and even though she liked her father, like, it doesn't really sound like she and her father ever talked or really had...
They just shared their stoicism.
Yeah.
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 It would just be silent weirdos together. Mm-hmm.
Even if Mama was the one who's betraying her, she was the only one that actually, like, tried, I guess.
Well, she took her in after her husband left her. She came back to live with her mom.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, it gave her something to do taking care of her mom.
Yeah, and the mother says, you know, like, oh, are you doing this because you're stuck here and I'm, like, trapping you here?
Right.
She says no.
Yeah, she just didn't really know what else to do with herself or where to go.
Yeah.
Because no one ever talked to her about that. I just feel like no one ever engaged Jessie.
Yeah.
And asked her what she wanted or how she felt or... But now in this moment, in this play, her mother is suddenly realizing...
Is finally doing that.
Yeah, that she needs mm-hmm. to do that. Like, oh, I never considered how you were feeling and now you want to kill yourself and I should probably ask how you're feeling now.
Yeah. And at the end, she's like, you know, we'll try harder, we'll do this and this and this, and, like, we'll make it work, and she really tries, and it's just, like, too little, too late.
Yeah, some of the suggestions are, I don't know, maybe straws grasped at down the, during the conversation. I kind of wonder, like, this woman who apparently was not very happy having her own family life, why she thinks that will help her daughter so much.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
probably just because that's what she is supposed to do.
Like, the force yourself to be normal and you'll just be normal sort of idea.
Yes, yeah. That was, like, what I could think was she was just, like, that's the only thing she could think of for Jesse, is like, you need a husband and a kid, and like somehow that'll, a lot of people like oddly think that will fix your life.
That's true.
And they are always wrong.
And say it not just in plays, in real life.
It can definitely enhance your life.
Right.
But it will never fix your life. You need to actually like fix it first and then do that.
I know how many times I've read in advice person or a psychologist or just a rational experienced human being say, do not have a kid to fix your marriage.
Oh, my goodness.
It will have the opposite effect.
Yeah. But
lots of people try to do it.
Yeah.
Or for that matter, like, the even earlier than that, the, oh, man, this relationship is kind of rocky. Well, maybe if we get married, that'll fix it.
Jesus, yeah.
Oh, okay.
I found the most amazing book in a used bookstore a couple months ago with Rhea, and it was, like, I think it was written in, like, the 80s or the 90s or something, and it was basically, like, a guide on how to catch a man sort of thing. And it was, like, you, like, once he starts being committed, you then have to pull away because he'll get complacent and bored if you're, like, with him all the time. And to, like, go on a trip for 2 weeks and refuse to call him, and then he'll get so freaked out, like, he'll propose to you kind of thing.
What? What?
And I was, like... Yeah, base your entire marriage on a fucking lie. What is wrong with you people? Why would you do that? I was like, that is bizarre. So it's kind of the same thing where it's just like, and I think a lot of it's like you grow up and like from young childhood, it's like marriage will make your life complete,
mm-hmm.
which is obviously not the case for a lot of people considering the divorce rate and how miserable marriages make a lot of people.
Sure.
Not that I'm bagging on marriage or anything,
right.
But...
You just got married.
I am married. Unfortunately.
Hey, Scott, you might have a conversation with me.
But it's one of those things that growing up you kind of assume.
Yeah.
Because I know that... Mm-hmm. You know, in school, even going into college, when they'd be like, where do you see yourself in 5 or 10 years or whatever?
Yeah.
They just always assumed like, oh yeah, by the time I'm 30, I'll probably be married and have a kid or two, because that's what people do, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm going to be 32 in a couple of weeks, and neither of those things have happened yet, and I don't feel a lack of it, even a little bit, like...
Yeah, as I've gotten older, like... That's one thing I've realized is like, oh, why do you have to be in a rush to get married and have children? And the older you get, like, the less, not necessary, that's not the word I'm looking for. I guess like when you're 17, you're like, okay, when I'm 24, like, I'll probably be married.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'll probably have a kid when I'm like 25 or whatever.
Right.
Because like, you just don't know things about life. And then you hit that age and you're like, how the fuck did I think I could possibly be married when I'm at this age?
Yeah.
Like, I actually still can't believe that I managed to get married by the age of 26. That is bizarre to me. Because in college, I was like, I'm married until I'm like 35.
Oh, always. Every time we would bring it up, you're like, I'll get married when I'm 40.
And everyone's like, shut up. I was like, I'm either going to get married when I'm 40 or I'm going to meet a guy and like a month later we're going to
right.
get married. Right. I'm either going to be really crazy or like wait forever.
I say, I've always joked that get married when you're 45 and not a day sooner.
Yeah. So yeah, but I think that's the thing. And so Jessie hit a certain age and her mother's like, oh, she's not married yet. Well, that'll help her.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter who you marry as long as you're married. And obviously that was not the right path for Jessie. Although I think she did genuinely care about her husband, but it just was not a good match, so. Our two moral issues for this play, obviously the first one is suicide, because even if that's not like, it's what the play hinges on, even if it's like not exactly what it's about, if that makes sense. And we've already talked a lot about it. I guess the ultimate thing to keep in mind is that the play is not endorsing suicide, and it's not necessarily saying suicide is always wrong, because as good writers do, they're presenting you a difficult situation and then not actually drawing a conclusion on it. So it's like, okay, here's this character committing suicide, and you can decide what you think about it.
Right. Like, we're gonna paint a we're gonna paint this picture, and you can decide what makes sense and what doesn't to you.
And I do think the ultimate, like, moment of suicide is a devastating moment. And I do think that, like, final couple minutes where, like, the mother is, like, trying to, you know, physically restrain her daughter and, like, crying and, like, that's Mama's, like, most powerful moment is she's just finally, like, begging her not to do it, and Jesse runs into the bedroom anyway and slams the door.
Yep.
I don't think that is supposed to be, like, well, it's definitely not a triumphant moment.
No.
At all. So, yeah. Yes, that's what I was trying to say. Sorry. So you can't really read the play and be like, oh, like, that character's really rational. That playwright thinks it was okay for her to commit suicide.
Right. Though, again, I'm sure there's someone out there who thinks that's the message.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what is, because we've said it's not really suicide, it's not really depression, it's not really epilepsy, so what is the message? What's the actual theme here?
Our final takeaway is communication.
Like, openness, yeah.
Yeah, honestly, a relationship in a family. Because mm-hmm. I think it is about family.
Yeah.
Because it's the mother-daughter pull.
Yeah, and they're really kind of able to have this evening moment, conversation, whatever, because they finally decide, okay, let's not bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's, like, there's no point to us having this conversation if that's what's going on.
It makes you kind of sad that they never did that before now.
Yes.
And you wonder, you know, where their characters would be if they had decided to be honest with each other, you know.
That's actually
20 years ago.
Right.
Just thinking, because I was like, when you read this, or I'm sure when you watch it, you're like, man, these people are like, this is really powerful. If they have conversations like this, like, that daughter would not be committing suicide. And you're like, oh, it's because this is the only time this conversation has ever happened.
Right.
And you have to imagine the 40 years of history where, like, this never happened.
Right. So it's not pro-suicide, it's pro-communication.
Right.
Tell people shit, man.
Right.
Connect with people.
Right.
I mean, that seems to be the theme of a lot of writing, is, like, make relationships, fellas. And ladies.
True enough, yeah. And a lot of the, for that matter, a lot of the things that I've read or watched that were kind of frustrating were because people weren't doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, any of the, this is a good friend of mine and of the show, I suppose. Alan always rants about how irritating it is to watch a show where the entire run of the show could be resolved by people just telling each other things.
How they feel.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Hey, tell him that you like him. Okay, it ends in episode 3.
Right.
All right.
Right. Like, why does it have to be 25 episodes or 10 seasons of building up to this moment? Why can't you figure it out and then, like, examine the relationship from the other side of that moment for once? Like, how come most people don't try to do that?
Yeah, I guess the most classic American TV example I can think of is Bones, where they spend like 7 or 8 seasons like dragging that shit out, and it's like, oh my god. But it's like, if they admit they like each other, we have to end the show.
It's like, no, you can examine the relationship from the other side. It
actually
can still be interesting.
Finally did do that, but they did it by her having a baby.
Of course they did. That's what women do.
Everything.
Yeah.
That's what we do. We have babies.
Especially on Fox.
Jesus. Jesus, yeah.
Yes. Anyway.
Anywho.
That's neither here nor there. Yeah. So talk to each other. One of the other things we kind of already touched on, I just wanted to bring it up really quick, was the issue, the feminism issue. The play was written by a woman. It stars two women who are both, like, fully fleshed and real characters and are on equal footing with each other. I read a good review of the play where I thought they made a really good point that if you see the play and it's unbalanced, like, one of the actors is better than the other, it ruins some of the power of the play. Because the point of it is that these two people are on equal footing and battling each other, essentially. And if the mother is, like, way weaker than Jesse, then it's like, oh, well, foregone conclusion. And if Jesse's a lot weaker than the mother, then it doesn't work either. So, and like we were saying, all the characters that are referenced, a lot of them are the men in their lives. And the men not being in the play kind of reflects the fact that the men weren't really there in their lives to be
with. Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So. Symbolism, maybe.
Perhaps so.
Maybe a little.
Okay, so. Points of interest moments. I already mentioned the Aristotle thing. And then the other play-writerly thing that I noticed was the Chekhov's gun, which is...
actually a gun in this play.
Yeah, well, yeah. It's a gun in his... like, Chekhov was a playwriter, and it's essentially, like, if you introduce a gun in a play, it has to go off before the curtains fall, or you cheated your audience. It doesn't matter, like, it doesn't have to kill someone necessarily, but it has to go off. Because the second you introduce a gun, all of a sudden the tension's like, oh, fuck, there's a gun on stage.
Right.
So
it's kind of like a tension and release thing.
Yeah. And this play follows that. Like, the introduction of the gun starts off the whole thing, and then the shooting of the gun is what ends the play.
Yeah. And then I just wanted to mention that the set design and the notes on that were fairly detailed and clearly were supposed to be an important part of the setting, and like the fact that it's not supposed to be regional, that it could be anywhere, and then maybe, and or that it's supposed to be cluttered, but like in a lived-in way, not in like a hoarding sort of way.
Yeah.
And that it's not supposed to be like kitschy. There's the taste isn't supposed to be what you're examining.
I really liked how she said, like, don't make the setting a judgment of Mama and Jesse's taste.
And then on perhaps a little more dramatic note, that you have your rooms and then like the hallway through the middle of it, you're supposed to be able to see the bedroom door, and that it's supposed to be like you're supposed to be playing with the lighting kind of throughout and bringing it into the forefront and fading back out, because I mean, you want to talk about symbolism.
Yeah.
That door, that is the doorway to hell, basically.
Yeah.
Right?
Like, that's where Jesse's going. If Mama lets Jesse into that room and lets her close the door, then...
Well, and I like how in the notes she says, you know, you should play with lighting, but she doesn't specify exactly when you need to, play it up. So it would be interesting to see, you know, two or three different productions of it and see where they decide to focus on the door and where they don't, and if it's different or the same.
I agree. That's actually one of the main reasons I'd like to see this on stage sometime, is to see what the director of that play decides to do with the lights. Like, when to bring it up and when not to, and if they would let it happen slowly sometimes, or like during some chunk of conversation, you all of a sudden notice the door, or if it would be like if you could just go dark and light all of a sudden at times, or how you would go about doing that. You could just think of a lot of interesting ways to play around with it.
That's one of the things I think is really awesome about theater and playwriting in general, is like no two productions of one play are the same. Because even if you do have a specific like vision, there's always stuff in there that whoever's producing it gets to interpret and play around with.
Right. Like this actor might make it a little more understated. This director might want things to be a little more this direction. A play like this one, if you're lighting people, do it a different way from the other guy, but you basically have the exact same play. Even that lighting effect in this play could really affect some scene, or some, I guess not scenes, because it's really one big scene,
but
different parts of the conversation and moments, exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that's really cool. Yeah, how you can do that, so... I'll go ahead and ask the questions in a minute. So, strengths and weaknesses of the writing. This is definitely not one of the things we read that needs to be edited down.
Yeah, my immediate comment was, well, if this needed editing, it would need to not exist. Because it's very short and tight.
It's kind of like when we read Doubt, and it's like, there's nothing you could take out of this.
There's not a single extra line of dialogue in that play.
You would ruin Doubt if you did anything to it. Doubt is amazing.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Oh, so good.
But in this particular play, so there's nothing that needs cut out. And one of the things that I really liked about this play was, I think sometimes dramatic plays can start feeling long, and I don't know if that's just like a more modern tendency for plays to be longer, or where sometimes the arguments start feeling repetitive, where you're like, okay, like, that feels like they don't need to say that again. And I think in a play where someone's trying to convince someone not to commit suicide, it could feel ridiculously repetitive. Because you're just like, please don't kill yourself, please don't kill yourself. But in this case, like, there's always new stuff being introduced, so I never felt like it was redundant. Like, it was always driving forward, even though they were always talking about the same thing.
Yeah.
So I'm going to ask your the question of the day.
Well, the first question is a little sillier. As how much candy does this mother eat? Because Jesse was talking about, like, the various jars and bags, and there's, like, an entire cabinet just full of bags of candy.
Right.
She's like, here are the peppermints, and here are the taffies, and here... I was like, oh my lord. And it mentioned in the beginning when she was trying to get a snowball. That was, like, the most exercise she ever got.
Which is gross, by the way.
Yeah.
And not candy.
Yes.
Yeah. What is a snowball?
It's, like, a gross coconut
it's a
thing.
Pink coconut cupcake. Thing.
If you're gonna eat something like that, eat like a Hostess cupcake. Like, don't eat a snowball.
Snowball's gross. Anyway. Twinkies, by the way, are also friggin' disgusting.
Yeah, they're not good.
Sorry, a Twinkie lover.
I've eaten a couple in my life, and I've regretted every.
I don't even know anyone who eats Twinkies.
I don't either.
I feel like that's an old person sweet.
Yeah, it might be.
Well, Hostess went bankrupt for a reason.
That's right. It's a nuclear age snack.
But I think the other more important question is, would this play still work if Jessie lived and did not kill herself?
No.
I
just don't think it would.
I think no is my gut reaction. I even would... wonder if it works if you don't hear the gunshot. Like, she goes into the room and... curtain.
And then you're just like, did she do it? Or didn't she? And then, like you said, people don't like that ambiguity.
People hate that ambiguity.
Especially American people, I think.
Yeah.
I do think part of the punch in the gut in this one is that... because, like, when she and her mom are talking about, this is what you're going to do after I do it, this is, like, what you're going to do at the funeral and everything, and the mom kind of starts coming to terms with it before she, like, freaks out again. And then after it happens and she's, like, really upset, then she, like, actually goes to the phone and picks it up and, like, does exactly what Jesse told her to, like, calls her brother.
And starts scrubbing the pan.
Yep. So.
That's pretty chilling.
Yeah.
Yeah, that actually was disturbing. Clearly intended to be disturbing.
So I think it works better with, like, that aftermath as opposed to just, like, did she or didn't she?
Right.
And maybe that's why it wouldn't work. Because I think when you go in that night, the question is Jessie going to kill herself or not?
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, like, if she decided not to, I think it would be really hard to write that ending without making it cheesy.
Right.
Yes.
You're right, Mama, I love you, and we're going to have this great relationship now forever, and so I now have something worth living for. You'd be like, this was bullshit.
Yeah.
I would probably throw the damn script across.
Well, first of all, it would not have won the Pulitzer.
No.
Yeah.
Not even close.
Like...
would have made whatever the drama equivalent of the raspberry.
Or, like, it's, like...
stupidest ending goes.
If, like, Daryl ran in at the end and, like, restrained her or something.
Wrestled the gun out
of
her.
When you ordered those bullets, when you talked to me about bullets, I knew you were going to kill yourself and I can't arrest you.
Or I ordered blanks.
Oh, God, that'd be even worse.
Funny if, like, the shot went off and Mama was, like, on the floor, totally defeated and crying, and then Jesse walked out of the room and was like, well, those were blanks. And just, like, walks off stage. What the fuck just happened in this play? Jesus.
Oh, my gosh.
That'd be pretty funny.
So, anyway, we're glad none of that.
Yeah.
So I guess...
the farcical version of this play that...
the decision...
Sorry, Paul Rudd.
...is a madcap comedy.
That ultimately, yes, Jessie does have to kill herself for the drama of the play to work.
Yes.
All right. So, Jessica, your verdict.
I really enjoyed it. I said I would really not want to read it again. I don't think it's sort of like when you watch No Country for Old Men. You only want to watch it again for another 5 years or so. But I really would like to see it produced because I'd like to see how you know, the differences in directorial decisions and that sort of thing.
I agree. That's almost exactly what I think about it. Go ahead and read it if you're interested. There's not a production around it. It'll take you an hour, but it's definitely not the thing, sort of thing you read and reread over and over and over again.
Yeah, and I mean, I think we come to that conclusion with a lot of the plays is like,
that's true.
That was a good read, but I really want to see it now.
Right.
and sometimes it's like a stronger feeling than like I think after we read The Crucible, I was like, no, I feel good on The Crucible. Like, I would like to see it, but I don't really need to.
Yeah.
But like with this play, or like with Angels in America, it's like, no, you really actually need to see it. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's kind of the point of drama in the first place.
Of course,
is
right.
Like, seeing it is the ultimate purpose of it.
Unlike podcasting, it is a visual medium.
Yeah. So, I don't know, maybe all of our play podcasts were actually missing out on something by not, like, going and seeing a production.
Well, hey, this is a reading podcast, not a seeing podcast.
Maybe sometime we can actually go see a production of a play and read it or something.
We should.
Cool.
Probably.
Yeah.
I want to be a guest on that one, too.
Fine.
Okay.
You guys can come visit me in Boston and we'll go see a play.
Sounds good to me.
Okay, so Jessica, what are you reading right now?
I am working my way through The Bully Pulpit by Doris Kearns Goodwin, the most badassest historian
ever.
Yeah, I
love her.
I have, as I tend to do with nonfiction, I'll read a few chapters, go away, come back. So I've come back to The Public School Advantage by Christopher and Sarah Lubienski.
I've been reading a lot of stuff. I was telling them that I've probably blown through about 4 books worth of fluff in the past couple weeks. So maybe the most significant of those that I've read is A Love Story Starring My Dead Best Friend by Emily Horner, about these teenagers who put on a play that their friend who's died wrote before her death, and all of their, you know, coping with her death and all of that stuff afterwards. So that's now that I describe it, it feels weird for me to say, oh, that's a fluff piece that I just read. She's dealing with her friend's death, whatever.
Well, that's like a specific YA subgenre, for sure.
It totally
yes.
is.
Yeah.
Okay. I forgot to ask you this when we were outlining. Do you have anything you want to plug?
No, I'm good.
Okay.
You want to plug eating sushi in about a half hour?
Yep, I'm good. I'm going to go with sushi.
I did want to mention that I started a new Twitter called at Classic Sum Up, and it's just classic literature summed up in one tweet, unfairly.
It's more and less our plot synopsis.
Much like our plot synopsis. But I was just like, oh, that sounds fun. So, one tweet a day. Yeah. I started with Jane Eyre.
Nice.
It was a, should you really marry dudes who have a habit of locking their wives in the attic? So.
All right. Well, if you have any questions or comments, or I always try to throw in some other version of words, or if you have words, just words.
Just words in general.
You can do that on our website, novelideaspodcast.com.
You can send us an email, novelideaspodcast@gmail.com.
We are on Twitter, @novelideaspod.
And you can also find us on iTunes.
Yep, and if you do that, then rate and review. So, next week,
we're trying something a little new.
Yeah, we haven't done a, well, I guess it's not a graphic novel. It's actually a graphic memoir.
Yes. So we read Watchmen, which was, I think, our only other graphic novel.
I don't know much about that world.
But yeah, we are reading Fun Home by Alison Bechdel in protest of the fuckheads who are trying to ban it, essentially. I've read it once, and although we try to steer clear of nonfiction, because we're not sure how to discuss it without just giving summaries, there's enough literary stuff going on in this one that I think we can come up with a good discussion of it. And we can also talk about the Bechdel test.
There you go. So next week, a little bit of an experimental episode of Novel Ideas. But I believe that will do it for this time around.
Yeah.
And we'll see you next time.
Bye.